It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, former Milwaukee Brewers owner and baseball commissioner Bud Selig looks back on his career in a new book. We'll talk with him about the changes he's seen during his time in the game. First, our next guest has a lot to say about leaders and leadership. Mostly, our leaders are bad at being leaders in the corporate world, and also that most leaders are men.
How long until you actually get this presentation ready?
Why don't you do the presentation?
Because
I
don't want...
You know how to do it.
What I really want, honestly, Michael, is for you to know it so that you can communicate it to the people here, to your clients, to whomever.
Okay.
What?
It's whoever, not whomever.
No, it's whomever.
No, whomever is never actually right.
Well, sometimes it's right.
Leadership in action on The Office. Is there really a link between being male and being a bad leader? Psychologist Tomas Chamorro Permusic tackles that question in his new book. It's called Why Do So Many Incompetent Men Become Leaders and How to Fix It? Tomas is the chief talent scientist at the Manpower Group staffing firm and a professor of business psychology at University College London and at Columbia University. Tomas, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, before we get to the men part of this, do we have a problem with leadership? Do we have a lot of bad leadership in our business world?
Yes, we certainly do. And what's frustrating is that the science of leadership is very well established. For about 3 or 4 decades, we've had a lot of research on what makes an effective leader, what are the assessments or the tools that predict whether somebody will be performing well as a leader. And yet, in most organizations, including for-profit corporations, we still play it by ear. We focus too much on the performances that people display in a job interview or in short-term interactions. And therefore, we end up with many individuals who succeed in their careers without really adding much to their organizations. So if you ask anybody who works anywhere in the world whether the majority of the bosses in that place are competent, they'll probably look at you and laugh.
And we'll get to some of that performance. We're going to spend a lot of time on that. But let's talk about the numbers now when it comes to who the leaders are in our business world. How disproportionately male is our leadership?
So it tends to vary depending on the level of seniority of those leaders. If you look at first-line supervisors or mid-level managers, in places like the U.S., it's not 50-50, but around 60-40 favoring men. But once you get to the top in executive kind of roles, it's about 90% or 95% male. So historically, when we look at the overrepresentation of men in leadership, we automatically assume that that's a sign that men have more potential for leadership, but that would only be true if most leaders would perform well. In fact, if you look at the data from around the world showing that the majority of people dislike their jobs because of their direct line manager, that people quit not their jobs but their bosses, and sometimes traditional employment altogether to decide to work for themselves or become entrepreneurs because they have been traumatized by their managers, then it is pretty clear that there is a lot of room for improvement, and the majority of leaders are not really delivering the results we would like them to deliver.
You mentioned how men can look good in a performative way. A big point in your book is it isn't just so much men and women as traits that we view as good leadership traits that are more associated with men. And I want to spend some time on a couple of those. One of those is confidence. If a man in particular comes across as confident in an interview, we look at that and say, aha, this confidence is the sign of a good leader. What's wrong with that?
Yeah, indeed. And, you know, in America, it almost seems crazy or heretic to say that confidence might not be advantageous. So I need to clarify this and what the research actually shows. It's advantageous for the individual to display confidence because they will come across as competent even when they are not. There is a reason why con artists and confidence have the same root. If we are preaching or worshiping confidence or any strategy or tactic for deceiving others, then that might help the individual advance their career, but we're going to end up with a lot of charlatans in charge. And one of the interesting paradoxes that we found in our research is that people who are deluded or deceived themselves yourself. So if you think that you're better than you actually are, and you are overconfident and overly arrogant or hubristic, you might actually have an advantage when it comes to tricking others, because there is no way to lie to others, no better way to lie to others than lying to yourself first. So it isn't so much that we actually prefer to have men in charge, but the qualities that we assume as beneficial for leadership are inherently more masculine than feminine, and confidence is one of them, because in any area of performance or competence, men think that they're better than they actually are, and women tend to think that they're not as good as they actually are.
But people might be listening and thinking, hey, confidence in and of itself is a virtue. A person who's more confident is going to be a better leader. You break down the research on that. Is confidence a predictor of good leadership?
Exactly. And the answer is no. And I think it's helpful if people apply the same logic they apply to other jobs. For example, if you're going to the dentist to have a root canal, what's more important to you, that the dentist is confident or that they are actually competent? If you're taking a flight to go somewhere, what would you rather have? A pilot who is competent or one that is confident, maybe even overconfident? What's interesting is that in any area of competence, there is actually a very slim, very small relationship between confidence, how good people think they are, and competence, how good they actually are. So more often than not, we have to choose between one or the other, and we tend to choose confidence because that's the easiest one to observe. But that's how we often end up with people who are not as good as we think they are and who actually end up not delivering once they get to the top.
Talking to psychologist Tomas Chamorro Premusic. His new book is called Why Do So Many Incompetent Men Become Leaders and How to Fix It? One little asterisk here about confidence, Tomas. You cite some research that suggests that, okay, if I'm a man in a job interview and I come off really confident, that's going to make the reviewers think more highly of me. What happens if I'm a woman who comes off as really confident in that interview?
We use different standards. So this is what we call the double blind effect. So, you know, it is in essence a lose-lose situation for women. When they don't display the same arrogance or overconfidence that most males, certainly male managers, display, we point the finger at them and said, oh, you know, they just don't want to be leaders. They're not leaning in. They have no ambition. But then when they do, we are intimidated by them. And we're scared that they seem like kind of kick-ass bulldozers or something. So we complain when women don't seem as assertive as men. And when they do, we are afraid of them, or we don't like it because they don't behave in a traditionally feminine aspect or way.
All right, that's confidence. Let's go to charisma, another one of those traits that we think makes a good leader. We want a charismatic leader who's going to inspire us. We tend to see men as more charismatic. What's the reality when it comes to charisma and leadership?
So charisma is slightly different because it's neither good nor bad per se. It's an amplifier. So if you take a leader who has, a lot of integrity, who is competent, who has technical expertise and knows what's right for their organization or their country, charisma will be a big asset. It would help that leader influence and persuade others to follow them. But what happens when the leader is incompetent, or when the leader lacks integrity, or when they have the wrong goals or objectives? In that circumstance, charisma will be incredibly toxic. This might sound like an over-the-top or exaggerated analogy, but if we think about the most brutal dictators in human history, people like Lenin, Stalin, or Mao, or Hitler, for sure they would have caused a lot less damage to the world if they had not been charismatic. So charisma is a very important tool to influence and persuade others. But when leaders lack competence or integrity, it's really destructive and detrimental. And it's important to say that we, again, focus more on charisma than we should. Take American presidential elections. I think after Haidt, the number one predictor of who wins a nomination for the presidency and the presidential election is who would you rather have a beer with. We know that the impressions that candidates make in short-term televised debates are hugely significant driving or persuading swing voters whether they should vote for one person or another. And in reality, that doesn't say anything about the candidate's actual competence, their ability to do the right thing when they're in the job.
We're talking to Tomas Chamorro Premusic. He's chief talent scientist at Manpower Group, professor of business psychology at University College London and Columbia University, talking about his new book, Why Do So Many Incompetent Men Become Leaders and How to Fix It? You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you seen people without the appropriate skill set rise through management, maybe where you work? Is this your boss we're talking about? Do you see this happening for men more than it does for women? Do you see confidence and charisma as being important for leaders, or do you think there are other qualities that make someone a good leader in the workplace or anywhere? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up a conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Business psychology professor Tomas Chamorro Premusic is with us. We're talking about his new book, Why Do So Many Incompetent Men Become Leaders and How to Fix It? You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you part of a management team? Have you hired leaders and managers? What skills and traits do you look for? What do you think about things like displaying confidence or charisma in that job interview? What makes a good leader? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Tomas, we've talked about confidence and charisma. You say not good predictors of leadership. They're things we tend to look for in our leaders. Men, they're associated with men more. If not those, what should we be looking for in a leader?
So what we should be looking for is first competence, which breaks down into technical expertise or, you know, subject matter expertise. And then the second one is general learning ability or learnability. And what we find today is that in a world where the landscapes of jobs keeps changing and future jobs are perhaps hard to predict, what matters is not so much what you already know as a leader, but what you are willing and able to learn in the future. So that's the first ingredient, competence. Secondly, people skills, which is about managing yourself and managing others. And then humility, integrity, and coachability. Coachability is really important because no matter how good a leader already is, they will need to get better. And the leaders that have the highest potential to develop, improve, and get better in the future, they show a lot of self-criticism, they show a lot of humility, and they even have a healthy degree of insecurity where they don't believe their own hype. I was speaking to a journalist last week who asked me, but who wants to follow a leader who says, I don't know? And my answer was, well, any rational person, because most of the important problems in life, you probably don't know the answer. You need to work them out. So if our criterion for deciding whether to follow somebody is that the person says, I know this for sure, when they don't, we're going to end up being in trouble.
How do we make the switch from these superficial qualities like confidence and charisma that don't apparently affect our leadership to the things, the humility, the willingness to learn that you were just talking about? This would be a big change, I think, for a lot of workplaces.
There's no, you know, silver bullet here or no simple solution, but there are three things that we should be working on. The first is to actually develop our own competence, because it takes competence to spot incompetence. Think about any other area of performance, music, the arts, movies, food, wine, whatever your hobby, favorite hobbies are. And to determine whether somebody is good at that or not, you need to develop expertise in that field as well, so that in essence you can distinguish between somebody who is a charlatan and somebody who is actually very good at that. Secondly, we need to trust our instincts. We need to understand that our intuition may have been effective 100,000 years ago when we lived in pretty simple times and spent all of our lives with the same five or six people, but today we can no longer look at someone and decide whether they're a good leader or not, because leadership is a function of things that cannot be directly observed: strategic thinking, curiosity, critical thinking, and intelligence. And finally, we need to actually focus on the right qualities. If we're really good at evaluating the wrong things, then we won't get very far. So instead of focusing on confidence, charisma, and even narcissism, which often gets people to the top, we should focus on competence, humility, and integrity.
We are talking to Tomas Chamorro for Music. His new book is called Why Do So Many Incompetent Men Become Leaders and How to Fix It? Tomas, a lot of advice, I think, for women in the business world and in leadership is to be more like men, to emulate some of the qualities we've been talking about that, as you mentioned, leaning in, the confidence, the charisma. What do you think would be a better approach when we're talking to women who are trying to break through some of this?
Yeah, and so, you know, this is a complex issue because I do understand why we see that advice being given so often. And, you know, to be sure, if I'm trying to help a woman today in a world where you only get noticed when you blow your own trumpet and advertise your own achievements and even take credit for other people's achievements and blame others for your mistakes, I'll probably engage or indulge in the same kind of strategies, Machiavellian tactics to help that woman stand out in a system that is invariably rigged. However, I think morally there is not that much to gain from such advice. Instead of pointing the finger at women and say, hey, why don't you behave more like men and even like incompetent men, how about we point the finger at ourselves or look at ourselves in the mirror and get better at actually evaluating talent, competence, or potential? So in a sense, if we do that, we'll end up asking men to behave more like women, being more caring, more kind, more empathetic, and capable of a healthy degree of self-doubt as opposed to believing their own hype and succeeding because they're very arrogant or overconfident. That's good for everyone. Whereas if we think that the solution to our leadership problems is to get women to behave more like incompetent men, we might help those women, but at everybody else's detriment.
Let's bring on a caller now. Joshua is with us in Milwaukee. Joshua, hi.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What do you want to tell us about Joshua?
You know, one of the things that we're trying to move to in my organization, especially in the division that I lead up, is giving more performance-based evaluation. So actually asking people to solve problems or to make proposals as part of that promotional application process. And then, you know, as a tool to kind of weed out some of that bias that we get from, you know, just the feeling that we get from talking to a person in a job interview to actually saying, can you complete some of the tasks that are required of the actual job?
Interesting, Joshua. Thanks a lot for that call. So, Tomas, somewhat more objective ways to measure than just getting that good feeling from somebody in the interview.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, any attempt to look for objective, performance-based KPIs, key performance indicators, will be a step in the right direction. Even things like upward feedback. So if you have managed a team, what your direct reports think of you, their views of you are a really strong predictor of your ability to lead in the future. And, you know, we are what we repeatedly do, and our reputation can mostly be crowdsourced if we ask the people who see us day after day to report on our behaviors. For instance, one of the best ways to predict whether a manager will behave in an ethical or unethical way is to ask the people that work for that person, do you think your manager is honest? Do you trust your boss?
Thanks a lot for the call, Joshua. We heard on Facebook from Brandy, who says, my professor worked at an insurance company. She says she worked for them, and they offered male salespeople base pay, but not women. She discovered it when women were constantly leaving. She left, too. So what about, I mean, there's still, in that story and others we heard on Facebook, just overt discrimination against women on the workplace, not even just this subtle, you know, psychological misreading of people.
Yes. And, you know, even though my book doesn't focus on that, I acknowledge that that is the case. You know, you have sexism, there is a glass ceiling, there is overt discrimination. All of these things, I think, we have been aware of for some time, and via laws and regulations, they can be undermined or at least tackled. But the issue that I think has remained more silent or less discussed is that one of the biggest obstacles for the career aspirations of women is the lack of career obstacles for men who are incompetent. In a way, the fact that we don't seem to care that much about competence or as much about competence as we think. And, you know, it's important to understand that this isn't a man versus woman fight or battle, but rather what I'm trying to emphasize is that a lot of the traits that make people more effective as leaders are more feminine than masculine. And historically, we looked at them and saw them as a sign of weakness. But after decades of selecting too much for hyper-masculinity, for being overconfident, abrasive, and maybe even a little bit narcissistic, there is now more need than ever for leaders who can display empathy, emotional intelligence, people skills, humility, and integrity. And if you select on these traits, you'll end up with not just more women in leadership, but slightly more women than men in leadership. That's why I think the best gender diversity intervention is to have no gender diversity intervention at all and focus on talent rather than gender.
Tomas, in our last couple of minutes, it seems like in business reporting and in popular culture, we have valorized a character type, the tough-as-nails leader, take-no-prisoners approach, doesn't worry about people's feelings. Are we getting this message all over the place, and it's going to be hard to break through that?
I don't think it's going to be that hard, because I think there's evidence already that people are witnessing the lack of results or the negative results that this kind of leadership actually brings. So in a way, we can hope that some of it fixes itself or that the system self-regulates, particularly as organizations who understand that leadership competence is not about being tough, strong, or aggressive, but competent, humble, and honest, will outperform their rivals. I mean, and there's so much data on this. Even Jim Collins' seminal book published almost two decades ago showing that the difference between very effective CEOs and the rest is that very effective CEOs were not just very hardworking and persistent, but also remarkably humble and low-key. The trouble, of course, is that there aren't any movies about these people. If they were, they would probably be more boring than watching, documentaries on many of our current leaders or, films like The Wolf of Wall Street, which captivate our attention. But to be sure, nobody wants to work for these people or have such leaders in charge.
Tomas, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Tomas Chamorro Permusic, Chief Talent Scientist at Manpower Group, Professor of Business Psychology at University College London and Columbia University. His new book is called Why Do So Many Incompetent Men Become Leaders and How to Fix It? Still time for you to share your thoughts over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up after the news, we'll talk to former baseball commissioner Bud Selig about bringing baseball back to Milwaukee, the steroid scandal, and more from his career in the sport. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a recent report shows that prices for Wisconsin's farmland are on the rise. We'll find out why and check in on how the wet weather is affecting the state's corn crop. First, not many people have had a bigger influence on the game of baseball than former Brewers owner and Major League Commissioner Bud Selig. From bringing a professional team back to Milwaukee to facing public backlash during the league's steroid scandal, he's been the face of some of the game's biggest changes in the last 50 years. He reflects on that and quite a bit more in a new autobiography out tomorrow. It's called For the Good of the Game, the inside story of the surprising and dramatic transformation of Major League Baseball. Commissioner Selig, thanks for being here.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Rob. Very lovely day, and looking forward to our conversation.
Now, you refer to baseball as the essence of your life. That started out early on with your mom at Milwaukee Brewer games as a minor league team. How did you get that love for baseball?
Well, I think you just articulated it. My mother loved the game. And when I was really little, she was listening to games. And, of course, I became fascinated by it. And then she started taking me to Borchardt Field. And so the rest is history. It became, even in my days in Madison at the university, everybody who was in school remembers how I would rarely miss a Braves game on the radio. and many drives to Milwaukee to see him play. So it really started with my mother. There's no question about it.
Now, you mentioned the Braves. They came and then went. They left Milwaukee. You made it your mission to get a team that ultimately became the Brewers. Why was it so important for you to have professional baseball in the city of Milwaukee?
Well, you know, I remember when they came. And I had been, of course, already a great baseball fan, went to Chicago a lot to see the White Sox and the Cubs play. And now all of a sudden, I remember an interesting story. We came home from school, Herb Cole and I, we were roommates. And can still remember standing on Story Parkway. This would be April of 1953. And there's this red brick county stadium, big double-deck stadium. And I can still remember that, oh, my goodness gracious, Milwaukee's in the big leagues. And it was a tremendous thing for Milwaukee, capped off by winning the World Champ Series and World Championship in 1957, coming close again in 58, should have won again. But and then the heartbreak of the Braves leaving. I can remember people in this city. I mean, it was sad. It really was sad. And but one thing led to another, and I found myself in the middle of trying to bring them back in the next five and a half years. A lot of heartbreak, a lot of sadness, but in the end, got the Seattle Pilots 7 days before the season started.
Now, in your time as owner of the Brewers, you talk about one questionable decision you made, hiring Bob Uecker as a scout. What happened there?
Yeah, that was Bob and I had known each other and were friends, and he had come back from Atlanta, and I began to use him giving speeches and that. He was already very funny, and he was great. And but the radio booth and television booths were filled. Schlitz was our sponsor at that time, so I finally said, yeah, I got to hire this guy. We're using him for other things, and then let's see what happens. So I hired him, and Frank Lane, bombastic Frank Lane, famous Frantic Frank, general manager, and he had come in to help me for a year or two, and he did. But he comes into my office one day, door comes, he comes roaring in with his, he's waving a scouting report, and I said, Frank, what's the problem? He's your guy, Uecker. Look at this scouting report. He was up in the Northern League. The problem with the scouting report, it had mashed potatoes and gravy all over it. So Bob's scouting career came to an end.
He ended up doing okay, though.
He wound up doing great, and the voice of the Brewers to this point, and made himself into a great announcer. He is a Hall of Famer, and he should be.
Another name that comes up a lot in your book, a main character, a baseball hero for you, it seems like, is Henry Aaron. Can you talk about him and why you think even with his home run record, you think he's kind of underappreciated to this day?
No, there's no question about it. Look, when I think back, and I'm partial, and I will admit this to you, Bob, Hank Aaron, I think, is the greatest player of our generation. Great right fielder, great base runner. Offensive statistics are stunning. 36, almost 3,700 hits. Broke Babe Ruth's record. But he played in Milwaukee and Atlanta, and I think it's only later in his career has he gotten the attention he should. I wish, I've said this before, everybody could have seen that man hit in the 50s before he tried to start pulling everything. Oh, my goodness. I've never seen a ball get hit like that to right center. He's a great player, and better yet, he is a great person.
Talking to Bud Selig, former commissioner of baseball. His new book is called For the Good of the Game. Bud, I want to talk about the performance-enhancing drug issue. You've talked about this a lot over the years. You write about it. You say there's a lot of blame to go around. I want to look back from the perspective of 2019 now. What did that do to the game and its reputation?
Well, there's no question it was a painful period. I think in the end, look, In 98, when Steve Wilstein, who was a reporter in Pittsburgh, saw Mark McGuire's Andro, that's what really set it off. You know, some people said we were slow to react. Well, we weren't slow to react. The union fought it, and they were public about it. So there's no, and this is a subject of labor collective bargaining. This is not something I unilaterally could do the minor leagues, and I put in a complete minor league program in 2000 for the 01 season. And it's been great. It's 20 years later and doing great. But we had a tough period there. But look what happened. We have the toughest testing program in American sports. We have the toughest test program, I think, in America. WADA, the World Anti-Doping Association, is really very complimentary, and they used to rip us. So I'm proud of where we are today. Remember, this was a sport that never had a drug testing program. Never. We went through the cocaine era, and we went through other eras, and so to think that we've come up with what we have, I think is great. Did that era hurt us? Well, I think people knew that we cared. I think, you know, our battles became public every day back in 2002, 3, 4, 5. But the program kept getting tighter and tighter and tougher and tougher. I hired Senator George Mitchell to do it, and that worked out well. He made 20 recommendations about clubhouses and everything else, and we took every one of them. So I'm proud of what we've done, and it was after that when our program got tougher, and we set attendance records. It was really remarkable. So, look, every era will have its trauma. I had a historian, Jerome Holtzman, famous Chicago Tribune writer and later became baseball's historian, who had, I think, as good a sense of history of anybody I've ever known. And he kept saying to me, you guys are overreacting. Every era has had its difficulties and its trauma, but we did something about it, and that's my whole point. And we should have done something about it.
You also write that baseball is really resistant to change, and that can hurt the game in some ways. How have you seen that resistance to change over the years?
Well, there's no question that I regard baseball as a social institution. Social institutions are really resistant to change. And so when it came to the wild card, if you remember, Rob, when we did the wild card, I got criticized a lot. He's ruining the game. Look what he's doing. And, of course, today you couldn't play without the wild card. And interleague play, revenue sharing, everything. There's no baseball hadn't made changes. I took over in 92. Really, we hadn't had any significant change in 60 years. And change bothers a lot of people in life. That's generally true, by the way.
Now, the Brewers just missed out on the World Series last season. Looking good so far this year. What are you looking at when you're looking at Milwaukee baseball today?
Well, it's an amazing story when you think back. I think how we fought for the team, how we got the team. And here's a franchise today in this market. It's going to draw 3 million people, or very close to it. Think about that. It's a wonderful story. Milwaukee baseball has never been healthier. They have a wonderful team. It's going to be a tough race for the Cubs and the Cardinals and even Pittsburgh and Cincinnati. It's the best division in baseball in terms of competition. But they have great young players, and there's no question, a wonderful manager who's a Milwaukeean and whose father worked for me years ago, so life has a way of coming out. And great general manager, and Mark Antanasio is the owner. I think he's done a remarkable job. So Brewer baseball is extremely healthy.
Bud Selig, thanks for joining us today.
It's been my pleasure, and I look forward to talking to you soon.
Bud Selig is the former commissioner of Major League Baseball and former owner of the Milwaukee Brewers. He talked with us about his autobiography, For the Good of the Game, which comes out tomorrow. You could share your thoughts. Do you remember Milwaukee losing and then getting a Major League Baseball team? If so, what did all that mean to you? What are your memories of Bud Selig's time as commissioner of Major League Baseball or as owner of the Brewers? What did you think about how the game did or didn't change under his tenure? Tweet us at Central Time WPR or send us an email. ideas@wpr.org. Coming up, for many of Wisconsin's corn growers, this season's wet weather has meant delays for their crop. We'll talk about what that means for their bottom line. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll be joined by an expert on Sudan to talk about the violent protests that happened there, the role the U.S. has played in the African nation, and a deal reached by military and civilian leaders. First, a look at some big agricultural news in Wisconsin. We've been having a wet summer so far. That's meant delays for the state's corn crop in many places. A lot of growers had to start late because of rain and cold temperatures at the start of planting season. And with wet weather continuing, a lot of crops now are dealing with issues from too much moisture. Kevin Hassett is the outgoing chairman of the White House's Council of Economic Advisors. He talked to Fox Business News this weekend about the wet conditions in the Midwest.
Mm-hmm. There was a significant Midwest weather effect with the flooding of the Mississippi. Mm. You know, there are all these ports that are closed. I-29 was closed. And so construction and transportation and warehousing employment was down, we think, about 40,000 relative to what would have happened if the weather was normal. And it's still a little bit of a blip down. But, you know, we're still sticking to our guns and we think we got a 3% year. The rest of the data is still looking pretty strong.
Plus, a recent report from UW-Madison shows that despite the tough time the state's farmers are going through, the prices of farm land in Wisconsin are on the rise. Hope Kerwin is a reporter for WPR based in La Crosse. Hope, thanks for joining us.
Happy to be here.
What do we know from this new report about our prices for farmland around Wisconsin, Hope?
So farmland prices have remained relatively strong over the last 5 years. We saw a slight decline in 2016, 2015, just because of the decline in milk prices and corn prices around that time. But really, land prices have remained strong over the last 5 years and actually increased in 2018 last year, potentially showing some optimism about the future of the ag industry.
Right. And that might strike people as surprising. I was kind of surprised because we hear about low milk prices in particular. What are some of the reasons out there that people are offering for why, in spite of this difficult time for many farmers, these land prices seem to be solid, as you say, or going up in some cases?
Yeah, so like I said, you know, the experts that I talked to, I spoke with a professor at UW River Falls who tracks ag land prices across the state. You know, he said that there, you know, this slight increase actually shows that there probably is some optimism that, you know, we'll see prices improve in the next year or so. It also is because there was less land sold in the state last year. And this really shows that even though we know a lot of producers are exiting the dairy industry right now in our state, that doesn't mean that they're necessarily forced to sell their land.
Interesting. So they might be going into, say, other kinds of farming or other uses of that land, but not abandoning their land completely.
Yeah, so they're not milking cows, but maybe they're raising beef cattle, or maybe they are just doing cash crops or renting that land to surrounding farmers. There's a lot of other options that they might have, but they're not necessarily putting that land on the market.
Another thought you wrote about, Hope, was that maybe larger dairy farms are looking to expand. That's driving some of the demand for this available farmland.
Yeah, we know competition among farmers themselves is a huge driver in land prices. And, you know, this kind of trend of farms consolidating, farms expanding has been around for many, many years. And so we know that, you know, larger dairy farms especially, or larger operations in the state, are potentially looking to expand in the future. They might not be doing it right now because of low prices, but that is always on the horizon just because of commodities of scale. And so that is really especially driving up prices, especially on the eastern side of the state.
You also talked to someone in the business who said that urban sprawl and foreign investment could both be playing a role. What's happening with that?
Yeah, I spoke with a rural appraiser who works in Illinois and in Wisconsin. You know, he really felt like investors, either foreign investors or just investors outside of agriculture, that those people looking to buy farmland to then rent to farmers in the state, has definitely been an influence on farm prices. And just because we know that farmland prices have remained steady, and so it's a safe bet for investors.
And southeast Wisconsin looked like a place that was seeing particularly high prices. What's going on there? Is that just because there's so many people and so more sprawl and more use of the land in general?
Yeah, urban sprawl is definitely a factor when it comes to land prices. But there's also just the quality of land and the potential income you can get from that land definitely has a huge impact on land prices. And so, you know, that area is especially prominent for cash crops, for corn and soybeans. And so, you know, if they could get a little bit more income from that use, you know, the land prices go up.
And Hope, before we move on to another agricultural issue, is there a thought that these prices are going to stay where they are? Are people making predictions that this is going to extend into the future?
Yeah, so as I said earlier, you know, this drive to expand, this drive to consolidate in the ag industry, that's not going away. And so it's likely that that'll continue to influence prices. And just because land prices have stayed steady, even during the time of low commodity prices, you know, land prices tend to be a bit stickier, as they say in the industry. They don't necessarily decline, even though, you know, even though commodity prices decline, you know, it's likely that we're not going to see a huge change.
Talking to Hope Kerwin, reporter for WPR based in La Crosse, about a couple of agricultural issues. We've been looking at land prices, farmland prices around the state. Want to turn now, Hope, to corn. We've had weird weather for corn growers. What kind of things are we seeing this season?
Yeah, so there's kind of this old adage in the ag industry that, you know, corn is usually knee-high by the 4th of July. It's actually tends to be a lot higher than that nowadays, just because of the schedules that farmers are usually on. But obviously, we're not seeing that this year. A lot of corn fields are a lot. You know, further back in their schedules. The last kind of data we have on this was from last Monday that showed corn crop was 87% emerged at this point, emerged from the ground. That's 20 days behind last year and behind the five-year average. So we definitely have seen a huge delay in our corn crop.
Is this a story about rain and too much rain early in the season delaying planting?
That's exactly it. I mean, we saw some people said record-setting delayed planting, not only in Wisconsin, but across the Midwest, just because of the wet weather that we had. And it wasn't necessarily the amount of rain. It was really just the continued rounds of rain that we got, that fields that were never really able to dry out for a very long time. So, you know, we saw such a delayed planting. And that's also definitely going to impact the quality of those crops as well, heading further into the season.
Yeah, talk more about how late corn crop impacts growers. And I guess it gets to be a nail biter maybe late in the season as you're watching for colder weather.
Right. We have a pretty set planting season in Wisconsin. You know, we have an earlier frost date than other states like maybe Illinois or Iowa that might be able to grow a little bit later into the season. And so, you know, we only have so many days for that crop to mature. And so that means that farmers are potentially looking at reduced yields. I spoke with one ag agent from UW Extension who said every day that a crop is delayed in planting can equal a 2% yield potential loss. So there's definitely that. And there's also a potential increased risk for disease or maybe problems in developing the roots of that corn crop. Just other factors that can really impact what farmers will be able to harvest at the end of the season.
All right. Well, I think you and all the farmers are going to be watching the weather closely. Hope, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That's Hope Kerwin, WPR reporter based in La Crosse. She joined us today to talk about why the price of farmland in Wisconsin is rising and what all the wet weather this year has meant for the state's corn crop and the people who grow it. You can share your thoughts with us. If you're a farmer yourself, what has the wet weather been like for you? Are your crops behind where they should have been compared to previous years, compared to what you were expecting? What are you doing to deal with the wet conditions? What do delays like this mean for your bottom line? Is it a nail biter as the season comes to a close, watching out for that first frost? You can email us with your story over at ideas@wpr.org, or you can tweet us at Central Time WPR. Again, email ideas@wpr.org or tweet us at Central Time WPR. I went to Devil's Lake yesterday. There's a good chance you did too. It looked like about half of Wisconsin was there. You might have seen me. I was the guy in the hat. it was still awesome, even with a lot of people there. It's always great to be there. But it got me thinking, okay, where should I go on those awesome summer days if I know that Devil's Lake is going to be crowded? Dean Knetter is in the studio with me, producer. You've got some ideas, Dean.
I have a couple options from the southeastern part of the state where I grew up. One is Harrington Beach State Park. This is in Belgium. You have a lot of Lake Michigan beach line. You also have an old quarry, which is now a lake. It's a gorgeous hiking spot. I always wanted to swim in the quarry, but I've been told that's extremely dangerous and not advised.
Don't swim in the quarry. Okay, that's Harrington Beach, and you had one more good one.
Yeah, the Lion's Den Gorge in Grafton. It's a county park, I believe. A little bit of swampland, some prairie, and a boardwalk that goes all the way down to the Lake Michigan shoreline. It's really nice.
Yeah, now Devil's Lake, the part of the thing, I mean, it's beautiful, of course, but you got all the options. You can hike low, you can hike high, you can paddle, you can picnic, you can swim, you can sit and read, whatever. It's got a lot of options. Is that what you're looking for on that perfect weather day at a park? Options?
Variety. You can go where your mood takes you.
Okay.
Without too many people.
Does it bug you? Yeah, does it bug you when it's too crowded at a park?
It does. I like a little bit of solitude, but still feeling like I'm out in public.
All right. I will try one of those. Still hard to beat Devil's Lake. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.